My name is Ben. I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Figure out what time it is. That's a lot of people. I'm very grateful to be here. I am very grateful to be alive today. I was born in 1982 and got sober in 2006 at the age of 24. And despite everyone trying to help me along the way, I almost didn't make it. And with fairly brief time today, there's not a whole lot about my past I'm going to go into. But I will say that all the cliches about alcoholic insanity were available to me at a very young age. By the time I was 21, I had dropped out of school and had my first geographical escape across the country. By the time I was 22, I had attempted suicide and had my second geographical escape across the country, as well as my first involuntary hospitalization. I spent most of age 22 in an asylum. You know, we call them what we want. There were different day treatment programs and all sorts of things that we do, but you know, it was an asylum, and I got moved around from ward to ward depending on what craziness I had going on, because I, untreated, am insane. I'm insane. Something about the way I look at the world is off. And I didn't realize it for a long time because I always had different ways to cope, but it's always been that way. I have always seen myself as separate from everyone else. Who knows why that is? But it was not until I made it to Alcoholics Anonymous that I found out that other people felt that way. A good friend of mine in this program has said that it may be that alcoholics are the only people who feel loneliness as a physical symptom. And that was my experience. I started drinking when I was in high school, but it didn't take off until I left for college. And when it took off and there were no boundaries on really what I could do, nobody watching me, I drank as much as I could. And I failed to see that I was any different from any other college freshman, and maybe I wasn't. But I couldn't stop myself when I started drinking, and I became a blackout drinker pretty quickly. And for a while, I was okay with that, because it was really the only way that I could be comfortable in the new social situations that I was in. At some point around the age of 19, I had what I consider to be my first spiritual experience. And I spent the next 6 years trying to chemically replicate that spiritual experience because it was chemically induced from the start. I was trying to find the formula, and it was better living through chemistry. And I did it with professional help, and I did it without professional help, and it was a disaster. It was just a disaster. Within months, I was depressed, I was lonely, I was all of these things, and I didn't have any solution but to dig deeper into alcohol and drugs. And so all those things that I talked about at the beginning happened. I experienced all those consequences. I ended up getting locked up. I ended up getting a DUI, going to jail. I ended up in these hospitals. I ended up attempting suicide. All of these things happened, and not a one of them could get me sober. There wasn't a one of them that I woke up from that made me willing to stay sober. I would swear off all the time. I'm never going to drink again. I'm never going to drink again. And some crisis, usually nowhere outside of my mind, would result in me picking up another drink. And actually, it was, you know, in the wake of that DUI that I started to realize that. I faced that consequence, and in between the car wreck and the court date, I was locked in a detox or a psych ward 4 times in a 2-month period. Because any time I was given physical freedom, I drank myself into oblivion. I didn't know I was going to do that. I didn't know that's how serious my problem was. I didn't know that's how dependent I was and reliant on alcohol I was. Because in those moments, I absolutely needed it. It was the only thing that I could trust to take me out of the way I felt. In the wake of all that, I burned my bridges at all the substance abuse places, residences, where I was trying to get treatment. And so they just put me in a long-term psych ward. At one time, I had had what I thought and what other people seemed to think was a bright and promising future, and I was sitting in February of 2005 in a psych ward with patients that had been there for decades. And for me, that served as a wake-up call. It certainly was not going to keep me sober on its own, but it served as a wake-up call. And I asked, what can I leave for? What can I get out of here for? And they said, the only thing you can leave here for are Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I had flirted with AA before. I'd picked up a white chip some couple years earlier. I'd maybe been to 10, 15 meetings at this point. And I began my journey into dependence on Alcoholics Anonymous and participation in Alcoholics Anonymous then. I started going to meetings. I was introduced to the Big Book. I was introduced to Big Book studies. I got a sponsor. I had all the information that one would need to get sober. And I didn't do the first thing with that information. And I was absolutely miserable and certain that I was going to drink again. I had been up in Boston, and as miserable as I was, I did what we do, and I ran home here to Atlanta to my parents. About 3 weeks home, dry, absolutely miserable, contemplating suicide again, I went to a meeting of the Alpharetta Group. It was their anniversary. And I heard a speaker. And I hadn't heard many AA speakers, been to many big AA functions. I didn't really know that was something we did. And I heard Bill Sanders tell his story. And I don't know why, and I may never know why, but I asked him on that day to be my sponsor. And I had absolutely no idea what I was getting into. I didn't know the first thing about Rock Eagle. I didn't know the first thing about Mount Vernon or even having a home group that you were truly devoted to. I didn't know the first thing about the steps in reality. I had read them off the wall and they looked nice. But I didn't know what commitment to getting sober in Alcoholics Anonymous meant. And at that point, in the fall of 2005, Bill began to show that to me. And that's really the process that I want to talk about at this point, because I think everyone faces slightly different obstacles in getting sober. It is a common problem and a common solution, but along the way, I think we encounter different obstacles. And my obstacle was, why does this have to be a spiritual program? Why do you have to bring God into this? I am very intelligent. I'm certain I can do this if you'll just give me the formula. I wanted to do the chemistry experiment in sobriety. I wanted to play the tricks and run the game on myself. And it doesn't work. It requires God. But I couldn't believe that. Because up to this point, I had spent my life not believing in God. Everyone comes from a different background. Mine happened to be atheist. God just wasn't something I believed in when I grew up. My parents lived good, moral lives. Neither of them are alcoholic. Neither of them have experienced the kind of insanity that would require a spiritual correction. I do. And I fought it tooth and nail. So I get to this point with Bill, and I say, you know, honestly, I'm just not on the same page about this God thing. But what I don't tell him is that I'm going to try and find a way around it. And I do just that. And what I try and do over the course of the next 9 months, which includes several brief relapses, is figure out a loophole that allows me to pretend like I am practicing faith in God when I'm really playing God. I felt like for me to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, I had to first define that power. I misunderstood when I was told to choose a God of my own understanding. I thought that meant that I had to get the complete picture in advance of working the steps. From where I stand today, that's totally delusional. At the time, it made perfect sense to me, because what I was really trying to do was to protect my ego from having to change. And so that's how it went. I could admit absolutely that I was powerless over alcohol, drinking or not drinking, because I have a very obsessive mind. And I thought about it all the time. I thought about trying to get that chemical fix. All that made sense to me. I believed that my life was unmanageable. I was never a successful, functional alcoholic. I just didn't make it long enough. It never worked for me. I never got off the ground to have anything fall apart. But my stumbling block was step two. And so I did what I saw other people doing. I showed up at the meetings. I showed up early. I engaged in the fellowship with other people. I read the book. But I didn't start doing anything. I came to the Rock, and I was a wallflower. I did not, as Jewel challenged us to do yesterday, attack my fears. I just hid them from the rest of you so I would look all right enough that you wouldn't corner me. And I robbed myself of a chance to grow. Those 2 times that I came to the Rock before I engaged in this process. So what ultimately happened is shortly after the Rock in the spring of 2005, things all came to a head. As a result of not working a spiritual program, I was not living a particularly spiritual or moral life. I had started making some pretty bad decisions. Bad decisions about drug seeking from a psychiatrist, bad decisions about women, bad decisions about work, and I had just generally gotten back into a very dishonest pattern, because I convinced myself that it was okay, because I had not gone through any kind of transformation, and I sold myself the same lies that I'd been selling myself my whole life. I made up an argument with Bill, and we got into it over this question of God. And I put on him the idea that he was forcing me to believe in his God. And that was totally fabricated. I made that up to protect myself from having to get honest. And I was the only person that I was hurting. And Bill saw right through it and said, one of the hardest things that I've ever had to hear. He said that if I was not willing to become more open-minded spiritually, it was getting to be a waste of time to work with me. And that he should go out and find somebody who would be more willing. Now, I'm sure that conversation has happened for a lot of people in this room, and I didn't deal with it very well. I just left. I just walked right out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I pretty much walked right out of life for about a month. Of course, I relapsed. At that point, I didn't have anything. I didn't have any defense against that drink. That relapse ended me up in Ridgeview, and I swore up and down I would, from that point on forever, do everything that AA told me to do, and I would never drink again. And 10 days later, I was drunk. Because that's how it goes for me. Swearing off is of no value to me. So here I am, 10 days out of Ridgeview, 3 states away, in a motel, thinking about this whole process that I've gone through. I become fascinated with all these spiritual concepts at different times, but all I have ever done is try and manipulate them. Try and make them fit my ego, my personality, my character defects. All I've ever tried to do is run a con on AA and on God and on myself. I'm not going to say I figured anything out that night, but I did take my last drink, what I hope will remain my last drink. And I got up the following morning and I drove about 70 miles to a monastery. And I felt very little. I felt pretty much totally empty that day. But one thing that will always stick with me is over the very peaceful cloistered area in that monastery is a sign etched in stone that says, God alone. And the thing that popped into my head were those three pertinent ideas that Donnie read. I had known for some time that I couldn't manage my life and that alcohol had me whipped. But I had spent pretty much every day since I realized that trying to find some human power, either within myself or someone else or some situation, some job, some financial plan, some whatever, some doctor. I had tried to find some human power that could relieve my alcoholism. And on that day, I began to admit that that would never work. And once A and B were true, I just didn't have an alternative. I had just run out of alternatives to relying on a God that I wasn't sure I believed even existed, and that I certainly didn't know anything about. And that's what I came back to AA with. A day and knowing very little, if nothing. And I came back to Atlanta, and I ended up in the apartment of a good friend the following night talking about all this. And for whatever reason, after I had laid out all the details of my dishonesty and these other conflicts that I'd had, I just felt so much better about not knowing what in the world was going on. I ended up in a conversation with Bill about a week later, where I was certain that he was going to say he wouldn't work with me anymore, that I just was not trustworthy, and it was still a waste of time. And he didn't say that. He said pretty much the same thing he had said in the conversation a month and a half earlier. He said, there are only really two things that you have to do. You have to know as little as possible, be as open-minded as possible, and trust that it's a process that works. And for the first time, I began to see the steps not as finding God and then doing His will, but as a gradual process of surrender to a power that can help remove from me everything that has made me so miserable and so useless for so long. And for whatever reason, with that twist, I was able to do the fourth step for the first time. I did the third step prayer with Bill, and he said, you know, you've said that you've made this decision for your purposes right now. This really means turning your will and your life over to the steps and making a decision to go through with them and see where that leads you. And that's something that I was willing to do at that point, and I don't know why. It was different than it had been before, but that was, I had some willingness. And so I did the fourth step very early on, and once I did the fifth step, I felt for the first time truly a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt like I could really identify with what other people were saying in meetings because I was just being a lot more honest about who I had become. I also felt more willing to share more of who I was because the worst of the baggage had been partially dealt with by revealing it to my sponsor and to God. But I had to move on with the process. And getting into six and seven, in truth, I just wanted to gloss over them. You know, I didn't really believe in a God that was going to do anything about any of these things. And, you know, if we could just get back to some action where I could tell people that I was having results, I would prefer that. And that wasn't going to be the case. I was instructed instead to go to the 12 and 12 as a resource on step 6 and 7 and to stay in contact with him and with other people about what I was finding out about myself and what I was willing to change in order for those character defects to stay removed. That God was going to be responsible for that work, but I was going to be responsible for maintenance of that. I got into steps 8 and 9, and there were some difficulties there for a variety of reasons. One, in certain circumstances, I was just paralyzed by shame and guilt. I thought that some mistakes that I had made were just totally irreparable. And in those amends, generally one of two things happened. One, I found out that the person was just so happy that I was changing that they forgave me. Which by that point, I had kind of given up on, actually. I felt like, well, maybe it's possible that they're not going to forgive me, but I'm not going to pretend like it didn't feel good when they said they had. And the second was the one I maybe even grew more from. When I went back and made some amends to some people I had harmed some years ago, their reaction was sort of like, yes, you were extremely selfish and inconsiderate. But that was like 5 years ago. I dealt with that. I was shocked at how unimportant I was to their life. And that was ego deflating in itself, and in the best possible way. In the best possible way, because I had really convicted myself of a lot more than I had done at one point. So I get into the process of 10, 11, and 12, which we refer to as maintenance steps, but in my case, you know, that's been as far from the truth as anything. I have grown exponentially as a result of 10, 11, and 12. 10 is, I was talking with someone about this last night, I'm just tired of being delusional. I'm just tired of tricking myself. And 10 is about continuing to take an honest look, because if I go, who knows, 3 days without taking an honest look at something, I'll be so far removed from reality, it won't matter. I mean, it just, I don't have a good frame of reference. And so if I'm not on top of continual inventory, I get pretty out of whack pretty quickly. And I manage to obsess about things to such a degree that that doesn't take very long. And so 10's about dealing with that. And 11 is about this new thing I've got in my life, which is a very young, sometimes insecure relationship with God. I don't know God very well. I don't know very much about how God works or why God works the way God does. And in some, there are some things that I am certain that I will never know. A lot of my 11th step is about getting comfortable with that uncertainty. Prayer and meditation about and for acceptance of that condition and all the other little conditions that we face in life. I try not to make demands of God or of other people in the form of prayer and meditation. That's just something I've been counseled to avoid. Another thing that I've been counseled to do, and counseled is not a strong enough word, that I've been just told to do, is strenuous work with other alcoholics. And that's taken a number of forms in the time that I've been sober. For those in the room that are very early in sobriety, I will say this. There are so many ways to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous before you are taking other guys through the process of participating in Alcoholics Anonymous. Were it not for commitments that I had taken at meetings, I'm not sure that I would have shown up for the meetings, but I am certain that I wouldn't have done as much to open up to other people at the meetings, because for the first time in my life, I truly wanted to feel a part of the groups that I participate in, and the experiences that I have had at Mount Vernon and at the Heavy Hitters are true family loving experiences. And I don't know if that would have happened if I hadn't said, yeah, I'm willing to stick around for a little while and clean up or set up or whatever, because that's when I began to open up to people. You know, I wanted to be at the Heavy Hitters to show up early enough to get a big hug from Floyd. You know, and I still do that. I still do that. And so there are all those things that we get to do to participate. There are, you know, things like the Atlanta Men's Workshop that give us opportunities to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Then, along the way, after some of that other garbage is cleared out of me, I begin to see that no matter how far down the scale I feel I've gone, I have experience that can benefit others. And so some months ago, I began this process of working with other guys. And there are two guys here today that I'm currently sponsoring. And it's just, it's such a rewarding experience. You see, in such a short amount of time, people's whole perception of how the world works change. And I mean, sometimes I feel like a not so innocent bystander, like I'm just watching this transformation. And it's that's the magic. You know, the power's been evident throughout. The magic I see in being able to stand back and watch what's going on in the life of another person. Just in the way that those amends are humbling, that's a humbling experience because it just doesn't have anything to do with me. I tried so hard to come up with some trick, some formula, some special twist on how to do all this or how to not do all of this. And every last bit ended in failure. I got to a point of desperation and just ignorance about myself that I let go of some of those old ideas because they hurt so much. Not because I figured anything out, but just I was just in so much pain. And I began to let go of those things and just do what I was told one day at a time. And today, I stand before you with a lot of uncertainty about different things in my life. But the one certainty that I have, which I never had before, is that I never have to drink again. I never have to. If I pick up again, I know now that it will be because I did not do something that I knew I was supposed to do to ensure my sobriety. I'm out of excuses. And there's a lot of security in that. There's a lot of security in having your excuses run out. And I'm just so happy to be able to participate in that miracle, the miracle that all of us are sharing today. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Good morning. My name is Bill Barnes, and I'm an alcoholic and drug addict. Thanks for the kind words, Ron. And I want to thank Bill and the committee for asking me to do this. There were three spiritual men and their wives on vacation and going in a Winnebago to Florida. And they were all hit. They were hit by a train and they were all killed. And they were floating up to hopefully get admitted into heaven. And the first man and his wife walk up to St. Pete and they said, I've been a good spiritual man all my life. Am I going to get into heaven? And St. Pete says, well, what's your name? And the guy tells him his name. And St. Pete looks down on the list and finds the guy's name. He says, can't let you in. And he said, well, why not? He said, well, because while you're on earth, you coveted money so much, you've been married to a wife named Penny. So he goes on down below, and the second man and his wife come up and said, well, I've been a good spiritual man all my life. Am I going to get into heaven? St. Pete says, well, what's your name? And the guy tells him, and St. Pete goes down the list and finds his name, says, can't let you in either. He said, well, why not? He said, well, because while you're on earth, you coveted alcohol so much, you even married a wife named Sherry. Well, the third man and his wife heard what had happened the first two, and he looked at his wife and he said, well, come on, Fanny, I don't think we got a chance. You know, I tell that joke when I start my story because Before recovery, my life was evolved around sex, money, and alcohol and drugs. And I sought those with everything I had in me. That was my motive for being in this world. Completely self-centered. How do I achieve those things? I thought they would make me happy. And as we all know, they couldn't. Scotty did a great job last night, and thank you for your wonderful story, Scotty, about talking about the feeling that I had as a child and about not feeling a part of, feeling different. I thought about that this morning, and I realized that until recovery, I wasn't able to look back and really understand how I felt. I had no tools to deal with the feelings of life. And by being willing to do the things we do here in recovery, I'm able to look back and go, yeah, that's how I was. And through hearing your stories, I go, yeah, that's how I was. And I look at the guys who came before me, and I go, that's the way I want to be. And so I proved beyond a reasonable doubt I could not do this stuff by myself. The cool part is I don't have to. I've got you folks and a higher power that I found when I got here. So I'm going to spend just a very little bit of time on what it was like, because y'all all know those stories. I'm going to qualify myself. And I want to talk a lot about what it was, what I did, and what it's like now. So I was one of those kids that would run around the neighborhood and never felt a part of. And I got to high school. I was kind of a late bloomer. I really didn't discover alcohol and drugs until I was about 17. But I remember all through my youth and teenage years, just now I know I didn't feel normal. But I didn't know I didn't feel normal. I just felt the way I felt and thought it was normal. So in high school, I discovered alcohol. And as so many people have shared before in their stories, the first time I had more than one beer, I had that immediate ease and comfort. I became better looking. The girls liked me, I thought liked me better. I became comfortable in my own skin. And for a long time, that worked for me. I progressed, we always talk about the progression of the disease here. And I can look back over my using history and see that it's absolutely accurate. I was a binge user. I would drink Jack Daniels like it was going out of style, and I would chase other stuff once I had had a few Jack Daniels in me. I would go looking for other things. I would drink alcoholically from the very start. So I was a binge user, as I said, and all through my using years, I would go, my typical modus operandi was to, I would have a bender, and then I would have a few days of remorse and guilt, and I'm not going to do this anymore. And then I would start feeling a little better, and I'd get back to work if I had a job, and then I would get a paycheck or something good would happen. I've learned that I used. People talk about I used because I didn't like the way I felt. I've learned in recovery that I also used because I liked the way I felt. You know, reason to celebrate, or this is going bad, so I need to numb it out. So I would binge use on and on and on, and until it finally in 1982, I was married to my first wife. I've been married now for four times, and I'll talk about that in a minute, because I burned three marriages down in recovery. In non-recovery. In 1982, I went out for a bender and came home, and my boss was standing over me and my wife was standing over me, and I was tore up and been out for 3 or 4 days, and they said either go to treatment or go or you lose your job, and that was the hook for me to go. So I went into a treatment program. I don't want to talk about a minute about treatment programs. I've been in two, and treatment programs can be a wonderful place. They can give me a lot of information that I didn't have, but they're really just a launching pad to come into the rooms of AA, to learn, to get a sponsor, and to work the steps. But I went into this treatment program as a 28-day program, and I think, the best I can recall, I got exposed to a couple of AA meetings, and of course I found those two AA meetings unappealing to me. I couldn't connect with with the folks that were there I didn't feel a part of. And the lesson in that for me today is that if I'm going to meetings and I'm not comfortable, I need to go find another meeting. There are tons of meetings out there, and I've been very fortunate in finding three meetings that I go to regularly. In fact, people that know me know that on Tuesday night I'm at this X meeting, and Thursday night I'm at this other meeting. On Sunday morning I'm at another meeting. I'm there every time if I'm in town, just part of my sobriety. So I got exposed to a couple of meetings. I didn't really connect with them, and so I got out of this treatment center, went back to work, and I was espousing sobriety and didn't have a clue what it was about. And when I first got out, when I first got sober this last time, I'll tell you, my sobriety date is January the 21st, 1993. When I got out that time, I used to say I stayed clean for 6 months. Real briefly, you know, I believe there's a big difference between being clean and being sober. And the difference is clean is being absent of alcohol and drugs. Being truly sober is being comfortable in my own skin, absent of alcohol and drugs, and not wanting to do any, and having a comfort of my own skin. So I stayed clean, and when I really looked at it later years, I realized it was really about 60 days I stayed clean. I started using again, and then for the next 10 years, I was out there. But as God so often does, he was working in that first treatment center because I had a roommate, and some of y'all might remember him. His name was Lawrence Potts. And Lawrence Potts was my roommate in that treatment center. And as this, I think, is my 28th workshop, my very, very first one 10 years later, I'm standing out front of the banker's building, and there's a tap on my shoulder, and there is Lawrence Potts. And it turns out he had gone back out for a while, but at the time he had 3.5 years sober, which was an eternity to me, and he became the guy that I worked the steps with. But before that, I relapsed after that first treatment center, binged regularly until I had the three marriages I talked about, and I look back and my history was very similar. I would find a hostage, I would marry her. I would stay married 3 years, and the last part of the third year, I would figure subconsciously, not consciously, that I can't keep doing what I want to do, so I'll divorce this one. So I divorced the first one, went some period of time, met another one, married her, 3 years exactly, same feeling, divorced her. Well, the third time around, met somebody, got married, great human being. As you all know, from past experiences, it's a lot easier to leave somebody than it is to be left. It feels a lot different. And the third time, this person was a reasonably healthy human being. And on my 40th birthday, I went out for my usual benders, and I came home, and she had been to see a counselor and had talked to him and came home. When I came home, my way of doing things, and this might sound familiar to some of you guys, is I would stay out all night on purpose till she went to work, and then I'd come home and try to sleep it off and get to where when she'd come home, I'd be looking to hear was, "Are you leaving me?" And she never said, "If you do this again, I'm leaving you." But I now know that she said many, many things over the last year that if I had been alert, she was saying that, but she didn't use those words. So she shows up after work that day and said, "I've been to see a counselor. I still love you as a person, but I'm not in love with you anymore. I want a divorce." Well, so that was enough for this addict and alcoholic to say, "Screw it," the proverbial F it. And so I went on my last bender. I ended up getting on a plane and going to the Caribbean and drinking Jack Daniels and shooting cocaine for 48 straight days, spending money, lots of money that was mine and lots of money that wasn't mine, to go through that last bender. I qualify to be here. Through the grace of God, I ended up in a treatment center called MAR. Some of y'all might know it, which I think is a world-class treatment center. And I think my sobriety really started there. And I'll tell you a story. when I think I can remember the day when I think my true sobriety started to happen. For those that are familiar with treatment centers, they have these group settings and usually in the residence, and they had them there, and it was twice a week, and you'd sit around with 10 guys in your community, and there would be a counselor, and you know, I was really tired of them talking about me. I wanted them to focus on somebody else just for one meeting. So I did what any good manipulative alcoholic would do. I started kissing ass and giving people rides and being as nice as I knew how to be. So just so for one meeting, they would talk about somebody else's issues. So the day comes and I'm feeling pretty good about things and thinking they're not going to talk about me. And we sit down in the group and they start on one side of the room and every single one of them starts jumping in my stuff. And I'm getting angrier and angrier, not hearing a word they're saying, getting angrier and angrier. It goes all the way around the room, and I'm thinking maybe the counselor will save me. Nope. He jumps in my stuff too. And I stand up, and I say, F this. I walk out of the room, walk into the apartment next door where my apartment was, walk into my bedroom, pull the closet door open, grab the suitcase that I had, threw it on the bed, opened the suitcase up, and said to myself, I don't have anywhere to go. And I'm really grateful I didn't. And so the counselor came out and he let me stay. And this is the point when I think my sobriety started. I then pulled each person aside and took them out on the balcony. And I said, what am I doing wrong? At that point, here was the key phrase for me. I became willing to hear what I didn't want to hear about me. Before recovery, if you were to say, Bill, you might want to take a look at this or say something I really need to look at, I would make it about you. I would say, why don't you look at your own damn self, or it takes one to know one. And I wasn't even willing to look inside and see, is what you're saying, is what they were saying correct? And that is a measure of my sobriety today, is am I willing, no matter where it comes from, and sometimes it's easier to hear from other people than it is others, but am I willing to hear from wherever it comes from when somebody says, hey, Bill, you might want to look at this. Am I willing to look inside and not make it about them, look inside and say, is what they're saying something I need to look at? And 9 times out of 10, is something I need to look at. I can't change anything about myself until I recognize what it is I need to change. And so, there's a saying I love. It says, you can't fix a broke brain with a broke brain. So that proved, again, beyond a reasonable doubt, I can't do this by myself, so I need to let you guys in a higher power that I found through working the steps I'll talk about in a minute. So what, again, a treatment center is good for is I learned about the disease concept. The huge gift to me was the realization that I'm not a bad guy. I'm a sick guy. I've got a disease that I didn't ask to have called alcohol and drug addiction. My sponsor helped me with that early on. You know, I'd been clean for a few months, 3 or 4 months, and we were talking about that. And he said, Bill, look at your behavior before you got here. You're robbing, cheating, stealing, doing all the things that we do. In the last 3 months, have you been doing that stuff? And I said, no. He says, well, that shows me you're not a bad guy. It shows me you're a sick guy. And boy, I could start taking the shame and the guilt for all the things that I had done when I was out there. And I could start hanging him on the hook of the disease. And realizing that I didn't have a choice at that time. I have a choice today, but I didn't then. So again, the treatment center is a launching pad. This is my first week in treatment, second week in treatment. I discovered a meeting that I immediately liked. I sat in this room, and there were people in that room who were laughing, who were telling stories, who were obviously comfortable in their own skin. And as I later found out, they had multiple years of sobriety and had good lives. And so that meeting met there 7 days a week. I was there every time they would let me get there. And good things started to happen. So I qualify to be here. And this rock is one of the mainstays in my sobriety. I come down here and I see people I haven't seen for sometimes 6 months. But I use this place to recharge my batteries. And I discovered that place being in that treatment center, this place in that treatment center. So I start getting sober and start getting on this journey. As I said, Lawrence Potts was my roommate back 10 years earlier, and he was here at the Rock, tapped me on the shoulder, and And I was attracted to him because I knew him already, but he had a long-term sobriety at 3.5 years is the way I felt about it, because I had 7 months at the time. And he started taking me through the steps. There are things that there's something I want to talk about that I think is a big part of the recipe, and I'll be real clear about the part of the recipe for getting and staying sober. I was taught these things, and I need to keep things simple. And the thing I want to talk about is the five things, which a lot of y'all have heard about. And again, they're part of the recipe, and what they are, and I'm going to talk about them quickly, and then I'm going to break them down, is the first one is go into a ton of meetings. Second one is get a competent sponsor. Third one is work all 12 steps. The fourth one is to learn how to pray. And the fifth one is working with others. And in the first one, how can I expect to hear enough of what I need to do if I'm not immersed in this stuff? If I don't go to a lot of meetings, to find the meetings I want to go to, and I'm going to hear that person that's got what I want, and that's the person. And I can check out at meetings who's the best sponsor here. People will tell me if I'll ask the question, who's sponsoring a lot of guys, who's doing the deal here, and I find that competent sponsor. And a competent sponsor is somebody who's worked the 12 steps with a competent sponsor. And so I go ask that guy to be my sponsor. And I want to ask a guy that I can't run a game on, that I don't want to run a game on, that I'm willing to be rigorously honest with, because if I don't, I'm wasting his and my time. And then I need to be willing to take his suggestions. And then again, the program is the 12 steps, is being willing to walk through them as he instructs me to do them. And I want to break the steps down quickly, and then I'll go on to 4 and 5, because I had no higher power when I got here. I mean, I was my higher power, and that worked out really well. And I found one through coming here, which I choose to call God. First step for me is being honest with myself that if I put the first one in, you know, right now, today, I have a choice whether to put one in or not. I didn't have a choice when I was out there, but I do today. And first step is being rigorously honest with myself that once I put the first one in, then my thinking changes and all bets are off. I'm off to the races. Absolutely, everything changes. Well, we talk about inhibitions, you know, and that's one of the reasons I like to drink before, was because my inhibitions would go away. But what happens in my thinking in step one is that I can think rationally right now, fairly rationally anyway. And if I think rationally, I can say my disease talks to me. It's the only disease I know of that tells me I don't have a disease. It tells me there's nothing wrong with me. It tells me I can do this stuff again and it'll be different. So it tells me that I can go do another one, or it'll be different this time, or I can do just one, or the proverbial effort, you know, and that I'll be able to recover from it quickly. Well, I need to be rigorously honest with myself that once I put that first one in, all bets are off. It's over. And all I have to do is look at my history. And I'm very grateful for newcomers that come into the meetings all the time that tell me, keep reminding me that it doesn't get any better out there to practice that. And the program talks about this is the only step I have to work perfectly every day. If I work this step perfectly every day, I won't drink or do drugs. But the problem is, if I don't do the rest of the steps, I'm still the same person I was before I got here. There's an old saying that says you take a drunk jerk and you take the alcohol out of them, you still got a jerk. So what the steps help me do is learn how to live a different way. So step two came to believe that a power greater than I am could restore me to sanity. I believe that most people in this room, and I know there are a few exceptions I happen to know, that are really not insane. You know, I'm not insane. My thinking is insane when I'm in the grips of this disease. So if I believe that a power greater than me can, which I choose to call God, can restore me to sane thinking, what have I got to do? My God gave me free will. That's the ability for me to think and behave however I choose. My God is not going to reach inside my brain and make me think a certain way and reach inside me and make me do the right thing. So if I want a higher power to restore me to sane thinking and sane behavior, what have I got to do? I've got to connect with Him. And there's three ways I know how to do that. One's prayer, one's meditation, and my favorite one is a conversational relationship with God. How am I doing? Am I getting ready to do the right thing? What do you think about this one? Would you be proud of me if I do that? So in step three, I'm making a decision to turn my will and my life, which I think is my thinking and my behavior, over to the care of a power greater than I am. So I'm making that decision to keep that contact and to improve that contact and to ask the questions of God. And I believe God speaks through you guys, my sponsor and people I respect in the program, and newcomers too, that I need to check things out. You know, my picker was broken when I got here. I love that term. My picker was broken. My picker of people, my picker of relationships, my picker of the right thing to do was broken. So if I want to my picker to get better, I need some help with it. I need to check things out with folks. Here's what I'm thinking of doing. What do you think? What gave me the willingness to start doing that with a sponsor, because I was still wanted to do what I wanted to do. What gave me the willingness was the realization that even if I don't like what he tells me to do, I still can go do whatever I want to do. That was the rationalization that I needed to be willing to go start taking important stuff to him, like the two biggies, finance and romance, two places I wanted to hang on to. You know, I wanted to do what I wanted to do in those areas. I wanted to spend money when I want to spend it, even if it was irresponsible, and I wanted to do things with ladies that I probably shouldn't do because I wanted the immediate gratification. So I became willing to go to a sponsor and say, here's what I'm thinking, what do you think? And what I came to find amazingly is that all he was offering me was a different perspective. And that really is what recovery is for me. I didn't know it when I got here. All recovery is a different perspective on way to look at the world. There's a saying that says, as long as I am dependent on how other people act for how I feel, I'm screwed. Now think about that for a minute. If I'm going through the world, which I did my whole life before recovery, I was dependent on how you act. If you didn't act the right way, or if you didn't like me, or then I wasn't going to be okay. And what the program has taught me is I need to flip that around. My perspective needs to change. And today, it's much more important, not what you think of me, but what I think of me. And what I think of me is based directly and strictly on how I think and how I behave. You know, what I was after when I walked in the doors of AA, and I didn't know it, was, yes, to learn how to quit using alcohol and drugs. But after a while, that kind of wasn't a problem for today. It then became about, how do I feel comfortable in my own skin? So that brings me to step four. You know, in step four, everybody struggles, seems to struggle with step four. And nowhere in the literature that I found does it say that I'm supposed to, when I write my list down of resentments, fears, sex conduct, and people I've harmed, nowhere in there does it say I'm supposed to go relive this stuff in my mind, or I'm supposed to go feel it. It says write it down. I've learned that in the fifth steps where I deal with those feelings and I deal with what happened with somebody who's going to give me a different perspective. And that different perspective is amazing. You know, I've learned that, and the big book talks about it, you know, people are sick. I'm sick. And I love the brain cancer story. A lot of my friends have heard this. It's very useful for me, and it's useful every day in my life. And that goes like this, is if I'm out in the world and if somebody is acting in their character defects, I believe people do the best they can with what they have to work with. But everybody comes to the table with some character defects, and wherever they got them from is not important. The fact is they have them. And I believe if somebody comes to me and they act in a bad way, if I hypothetically knew that they had brain cancer, literally had brain cancer, that it was eating their brain up and it was making them behave a certain way, how would I look at them? I would look at them as if they're sick. I would have patience and tolerance because they can't help it. Well, I suggest that people's character defects is exactly the same thing as having brain cancer. And what that does for me is I get better and better. I'm not perfect at any of this, but I've gotten better at letting people be who they are. You know, people have the right to be who they are. It's when I learn to give them the right to be who they are, I get to keep some peace about me. You know, the serenity prayer. I want to have peace and serenity in my life. So this program gives me a different perspective on how to get that. So in the fourth step, I just write this stuff down. I get to five, and I talk with a sponsor about sickness. You know, I'm sick. I need to be forgiven. You know, God would forgive me, so I need to forgive myself. And all the people that have harmed me, are they sick? Yes. So what do? I forgive them. Guess who's the one that benefits when I forgive people? Me. And is it what God would have me do? Absolutely. You know, people come, There's a funny thing about halfway houses, too. I'll have guys call me up and say, you know, Johnny stole my baloney. And I'll say something to this effect. I'll say, why does it surprise you that people in a halfway house aren't acting healthy all the time? And they'll say, it doesn't surprise me. I say, well, yes, it does. You know, you're complaining about God stealing your baloney or not going to meetings or not doing what they're supposed to be doing. You know, it shouldn't surprise me whether people are in a halfway house or out in the world that they're not doing what they're supposed to do. It should be a pleasant surprise when people do the right thing instead of a surprise when people don't. And if I go about it with that perspective, I get to go through life a lot more comfortably. So get through five, and six and seven are my favorite two steps. And the reason it is because it deals with character defects and character qualities. I've been taught that character defects are the problem in my situation. The spiritual axiom is that whenever I'm disturbed, there's something wrong with me. I'll say that again. Whenever I'm disturbed about whatever it is, there's something wrong with me. And there's another illustration I really love, and it's about Mahatma Gandhi and Hitler. And everybody remembers the Hitler from World War II. And you can pick whatever spiritual guru you want to, Mahatma Gandhi, whoever you want. But let's say that Timmy Hansen standing up here on the stage, and the Hitler from World War II is sitting in one chair, and right next to him in another chair is Mahatma Gandhi. And Timmy gets right over him, and he starts pointing down at him, and he starts calling him every name in the book and angrily yelling at Hitler. What's Hitler going to do? Hitler's going to react with character defects. He's going to maim you slowly and probably kill you. But then Timmy walks over to Mahatma Gandhi, or again, whichever spiritual person you want to think of, and he says the exact same words with the exact same emotion. What's Mahatma Gandhi going to do? He's going to smile at you, and he's going to pray for you, and he's going to see how he's going to help. What the illustration shows me is that it's not what people say to me that matters. It's that how am I going to receive it? Am I going to react with character defects like Hitler, or am I going to respond with character qualities like Mahatma Gandhi? That's a really cool thing for me to understand, that I have a choice today on how I'm going to feel. Life is going to happen. Life is going to happen. What changes in recovery is how I go through life, how I perceive it, how I respond to it. My wife's going to be who she's going to be. My job's going to be what it's going to be. Traffic is going to be what it's going to be. What changes for me is how I receive that stuff and how I respond to it. Now, you know, I am by no means perfect at this stuff. And, you know, my sponsor used to say two things to me. He used to say, Bill, you're right where you're supposed to be right now. I wanted to be 20 years sober, you know, at 6 months. And so he'd say, you're right where you're supposed to be right now. And then the other thing is, there's nowhere to get to. I always used to be one of these guys who used to show me how to do this. I'll figure it out. Then I'll be there. And I'm grateful today that there's nowhere to get to. What recovery is for me today is practicing on a daily basis, trying to get a little better at practicing the tools that these steps have given me so that I can go through life in a comfortable and happy, joyous way. So character defects are the problem. Character qualities are the solution. When I'm impatient, I'm in trouble. I'm in pain. If I become patient, I have some relief. If I'm dishonest, I'm in pain. If I'm honest, I'm not. On and on and on and on. So brings me to 8 and 9. 8 again is just writing a list and becoming willing. And 9 is making the amends. And a 9th step, amends, the two things people project about, and I want to talk real briefly about the projection, what projection is. This is besides a higher power and finding God in prayer, learning how not to project has become the most useful tool I've learned in recovery. And the definition that I like of projection is anytime I'm in my thinking, worried about something in the future or in the past that I can do nothing about at this moment, I'm taught that as a useless, harmful exercise. There's a difference between planning and projecting. Planning is a good thing. The illustration is I get a letter in the mail today that says I'm in from the court and I'm in big trouble. I got to go to court in 2 weeks. I feel that. I call them zingers. Ugh, it feels terrible. Okay. Planning is a good thing. Is what can I do about it right this moment that will have a positive effect about my court case in 2 weeks? I can call an attorney and I can educate him on the case. That's a good thing. The projecting part is to worry every single day what's going to happen when I go to court. I'm going to court, I'm going to jail, I'm going to this. And to amend the illustration a little bit, is about if I have to have a job and I've got an interview, I've done the planning, I've got an interview in a week. So I've done the good part, and I'm really desperate for a job. Projecting would be, I've got to have this job, got to have this job, got to have this job. I don't bother to go do some more planning and look for other jobs in case I don't get this one. So I've worried. I get up and I show up for this interview. What kind of interview do you think it's going to be? You know, I'm not going to ask the question to see if I even want the job. I'm going to take less money than I should. I'm going to appear desperate. The interview is going to go badly. Conversely, if I'll do what the program teaches me, which is to have faith that it's going to work out in God's plan, and I keep doing the work to find other jobs, then if I show up for that interview, don't worry all week, and show up for that interview and say, if I'm supposed to have this job, God will give it to me, how do you think the interview is going to go? A lot better. So, and I have tons of experience with projecting. It is the most harmful thing I do. And my sponsor had me look at my thinking. One of his assignments was, take a look at your thinking. How much of it early in recovery is projection? And about 99% of my thinking was either in the future or in the past, instead of what am I doing to make right now better. So back to a ninth step. But people project about the fifth step and the ninth step, and there's absolutely nothing to project about. Ninth step for me was an incredibly rewarding experience. And real briefly, the two, to tell you a good amend and a bad amend. A good amend is, hey Jim, this is Bill Barnes. I'm working on myself as a human being. I stole $100 from you, and I want to know what I can do to make it right. And then I sit and listen. And then if what they ask is reasonable, I do it. A bad amend is, hey Jim, it's Bill Barnes here. I stole $100 from you. I want to know what I can do to make it right. But you know, I'm a crack addict and I'm an alcoholic and I got dropped on my head as a kid. You know, I'm excuse. That's not what that's about. It's about cleaning up my side of the street. And that's again when the promises come true, is when I get halfway through or through with the ninth step. So, 10, taking a personal inventory every day. You know, I do an inventory at night, but I really like the part it talks about in the big book about doing it throughout the day. You know, I think it's useful to me to look at my clock on the hour and just look back over the hour and say, how did I do? And check it out with God, you know. How did I do? And I've gotten to a place where I know if I yelled at somebody or I told a lie or I acted badly, I know it today. But I had to learn to look for that. And so I can then clean up the wreckage of my past right then. So in theory, for me, except for things I may have forgotten about the first time around doing a fourth and fifth step, if I do a good tenth step every day, I should never have to do another fourth step, because I'm cleaning up the wreckage of my future or my past now as I go. And I get to go to bed at night with a clean conscience, and I feel good about myself. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact. You know, I had no conscious contact with a higher power when I got here, and so I need to practice. You know, we always hear the term, practice these principles in all of our affairs. If I was already good at something, we need to practice it. I need to practice that, because it says, practice these principles in all of my affairs. Why would I want to do that? Because I'm the one that benefits. There's no way I got to here from where I started. That's the magic and the miracle of the 12 steps. I don't know how much time I've got left, but I want to jump ahead just a little bit. Step 12, and then I'm going to jump ahead a little further. Step 12 is working with others, and that's where the real magic has happened for me. Whatever understanding I have of the 12 steps today did come from working with my original sponsor, but it has much more come from working it with many guys. When I sit and talk about a step 6 and 7, character defects with character qualities, with a sponsoree, what do you think it does for me? It gets me to look at my character defects and my work in the stuff, and it helps me understand the step even better. So, and get to see the light come on is an amazing thing. So working with others is what it's about. For those, I talked about being married 4 times. This is one of the miracles of recovery. And picture this scene. I have met a girl in recovery who is a 38-year-old non-alcoholic addict who owns her own home, has got a little savings, got a good job, who's a spiritually fit human being. And I've actually met her and been able to walk through a start of a relationship, and actually when it was time, not the first date or the second date, tell her about my history, expose her to the program, to where she starts to fall in love with me. And then we fall in love, and I think about marriage to this woman, and I'm to that place where I want to get married. Think about this scene. Walking into her parents' house and sitting down and being able to say, George and Helen, I'd like to have your daughter's hand in marriage, but by the way, you need to know I've been married 3 times and I'm a recovering alcoholic and drug addict. And I was able to do that. And they love me today. And it makes me tear up. I'm married to an incredible woman. A lot of y'all know her. Her name's Gigi. And she works, a non-alcoholic drug addict who chooses to work 4 days a week at a treatment center. Because she loves us. She loves the program. And I'm a very blessed man. The biggest gifts I have been given in recovery are the way I feel about me. And it's not an ego thing. It's not, hey, look at me, I'm cool. It's that healthy self-esteem and healthy self-respect that that I was looking for all my life, didn't know how to get. And that has come directly from me being in the middle of the bed of recovery. And for those that don't know what the middle of the bed of recovery is the illustration is you know, if you have a double bed and you're laying right in the middle of it and there's kind of an earthquake, you might roll over a little bit, but you stay in the bed. Whereas if I slack off on doing the things that I know to do here, and we hear the stories all the time, so I quit going to meetings and I relapsed, or I quit talking to a sponsor, or whatever, I'm getting on the edge of the bed. And so if I have something that rocks my world a little bit, I can fall off. So I've learned to stay in the middle of the bed. I watch the guys that come before me who are doing this deal, and they stay in the middle of the bed. So I could talk for hours and hours about this program because I absolutely love it. And there's so many incredible tools. And I look at my friend Blake here on the front row, who is 23 years old, and he's got multiple years of clean time. What a blessing, God. Blake, I can't wait to see you, and I hope I'm still around in 30 years to see the wisdom that you're imparting to all the guys you work with. He sponsors people. He's doing the deal. So, guys, thanks for letting me be here. I'm very thankful I'm sober, and thanks to The Rock.